The Book Nook on WYSO is made possible by five local library systems in Southwest Ohio: the Greene County Public Library, Washington Centerville Public Library, Clark County Public Library, the Dayton Metro Library, and the Wright Memorial Public Library.
Good morning, you're listening to WYSO in Yellow Springs. I'm Vic McCunis, and we have the Book Nook coming up for you. And today we'll be talking to Bill Newman about a very special book. As you know, WYSO is the Antioch College radio station serving Southwest Ohio. And Bill has just written a book about his experiences at Antioch and a lot of other things. It's called Life on the Co-op Plan: Lessons from a 167-year-old Startup. It's a fascinating look at this very important institution, and that's coming up right after NPR News. Hello, welcome to the Book Nook on WYSO. I'm Vic McCunis, and I'd like to welcome to the program today Bill Newman. He joins us by telephone from Massachusetts. Hello, Bill.
Hi, thanks so much for having me. I appreciate it.
It's our pleasure. Bill, you've got a new book coming out, and it's a very interesting book. It's called Life on the Co-op Plan: Lessons from a 167-Year-Old Startup. How did you get the idea for this?
Well, I wrote a book that was published a little over 3 years ago that was titled When the War Came Home. And I was talking to Tom Manley, president of Antioch College, about it. And I went back and looked at that book. And I said, this is really interesting if you look at it from an Antioch College point of view, as opposed to what its primary focus was, which was an involvement in the anti-Vietnam War movement point of view. And I thought there was a book in that book, a different book. And so I went back, I rewrote some pieces of it. I took out a number of pieces. I included some more recent writing that I have done. I shaped the story around co-ops in Antioch, and I think it worked. There's a new book. There's a different book. It's a very different book. And I think it tells this story of lessons from a 167-year-old startup. So I asked Tom Manley about it. He thought it was a good idea. We've gone back and forth, and here we go. We have a book.
Some of our listeners are probably unfamiliar with some of the terminology in the title. For instance, the term co-op, which is a very important term, and the reference to the 167-year-old startup. What are you referring to?
Well, the co-op is the Cooperative Education Plan, the work-study plan at Antioch College and other places as well. I should note I went to law school on a co-op plan as well after Antioch, 4 years at Antioch on the co-op plan. I spent another 3 years at Northeastern University School of Law on a co-op plan. It's, again, co-op, short for Cooperative Education, Work-Study Education, and the integration of the two. Lessons from a 167-year-old startup. That's really the title of Antioch College President Tom Manley's speech about the college and the reborn Antioch College, which is, we are a startup. We're a 167-year-old startup, but we're a startup.
And you mentioned the co-op program, and when you were 18 years old, you got involved in a co-op program, and you talk about it in the book, that was so intense and so interesting for you. It really kind of puts you on a trajectory for your future career. And you also got into a position where, and I've heard of this before, you were gone too long, and they contacted you. They said, hey, you need to come back.
That's true. It's kind of somewhere between a demand and a cajoling kind of letter saying, you really need to come back to school. Because I went to Antioch in the summer of 1968, and I didn't return to the fall of 1969. For 9 months, I was working in New York for the Vera Institute of Justice for its then experimental Manhattan Court Employment Project. it was one of the first, if not the first, alternative sentencing programs in the criminal justice system in the United States. And four Antioch students were hired by the program to be the screeners for the program. That is, we were the people who read the police reports and the criminal records and all the other paperwork that came through the arraignment session. We determined which one of the individuals who had been arrested in Manhattan might be eligible for this program, and then we would go and interview those persons, those defendants, in the jail behind the arraignment session in Manhattan Criminal Court. And you're right. I think I write about this as a transformational experience, and I hope I do, because it was. I'd never seen anything like this. I'd never imagined this world. It was really quite extraordinary. And being counselors of the program made the entire experience all the more powerful. All of the counselors in the program, they were all trained, of course, had done hard time, serious time, 7, 8, 9, 10 or more years in upstate New York prisons. So when they counseled and spoke to and ran the groups for these young offenders or these persons accused of crimes, they knew of what they spoke when it came to both hard time and the system and how it works and what these young men might be able to do to turn their lives around. So I think it was a very powerful and a statistically successful program for those persons accused of crimes who were selected for it. It was also very powerful for me. I mean, I was 18 years old, and I'm standing in front of a judge or judges in the New York criminal courts making a plea for someone's case to be held in abeyance while they attended a rehabilitation program, and if they were successful, then to have the charges dismissed. And the public defenders would ask us to make the presentation. And we'd talk to the defense lawyers, we'd speak to the prosecutors, we'd address the judge. I was 18 years old. No one told me that this was beyond what an 18-year-old was supposed to be doing. So I did it. It's only after the fact where I said, what an experience. That was amazing. Who gets to do that? And the answer is and was Antioch students. That's who.
I can picture you standing there in the courtroom with your voice maybe a little squeaky and a little nervous and just going forward and getting experience and doing it more and more and getting better at it. And all these years later, after that first Antioch co-op, here you are. Tell our listeners what you've been doing in the intervening years and how that co-op led to your current career. And tell us about your day job.
Okay. Well, I went to law school, as I mentioned. I went to Northeastern University School of Law. I spent another 3 years on co-ops, and those co-ops from Northeastern, including working for two small civil rights and criminal defense firms. I also worked for the public defenders in Alaska and for legal services on the southern border in Texas. After law school, I was admitted to the Massachusetts Bar. I've been practicing in Northampton, Massachusetts for the past 41 years, give or take. And I've been the director of the Western Massachusetts Office of the American Civil Liberties Union for about the past 30. Technically, it's the Western Regional Law Office of the American Civil Liberties Union of Massachusetts, but that's a mouthful. So I usually just say the Western director of the Western Massachusetts ACLU office, and that is my day job. I still have a bit of a private practice left for those cases which come to me that I can't fairly say are ACLU cases, but those are mostly political cases that I want to do because I believe in the cause. And I have another job I've had for the last 6, 7 years, which is I have a radio show, a talk radio show on WHMP and its affiliated stations here in the Valley, and I do that 5 mornings a week. So I'm a little busy, but I think it's terrific. Two great jobs.
Mm. Tell us about your radio show.
Well, we have an eclectic mix of guests. We have politicians and authors and scientists. We have musicians and just a plethora of individuals who come to the Valley and or live in the Valley and talk about their work or their new book or something that has been important to them recently. So, we also have a number of segments. We have a segment from an astronomer who's a professor at Hampshire College called Salman Hamid's Ridiculously Large and Largely Ridiculous Universe, and we talk about what we call breaking news from outer space. We have a regular segment called Black in the Valley, what it's like to be black in this valley. It started because we had a show on Martin Luther King Day 6 or 7 years ago with four black friends. Some were better friends than others, but I knew them all to some degree. And I asked them a question, which I said, listen, I've been afraid to ask you this. I've known some of you a really long time, but it's awkward. But I would like to ask, which is, what is it like really to be black in this valley, which the Northern Valley here is really quite white. Many more people of color in the southern part of the Pioneer Valley, Holyoke and Springfield. And I asked that question, and to a person, they said, thank you for asking that. It's something that no one really wants to talk about, but we want to talk about it. And so we have been for the last 7 years. So Black in the Valley is one of our regular segments. It's been going on since then. We have a segment called Political Gold with Josh Silver. Josh Silver was the founder of Free Press. He now is the founder and director of an organization, Represent Us, represent.us, which is dedicated to getting big money out of politics. And Josh is a terrific guest. And on those days, some days when I can't host the show for reasons, including I have to be in court, he guest hosts for me, and he's absolutely terrific on that. We have other regular segments that include, well, for example, Once Upon a Time. This is with children book author Jane Yolen. We have a segment called The Reverend and the Rabbi. It's Reverend Peter Ives, Rabbi Justin David, and they bring on religious and social religious leaders and social activists on their segment as well. And that started because of a Christmas Eve show we did right after the show began, and they didn't know each other very well, and it was a love fest. I don't know that I've had as good a show since, but these two men were just spectacularly on the same page in their feeling about life and religion and spirituality, and we've kept that for the last 7 years. Again, it just started, and we've kept it. So we have a segment called Vaya con Muñoz, because Natalia Muñoz is a longtime newspaper reporter here, and well, we like the title, and we love talking to her as well. We have a segment that ends the week called Inside Out, What to Do Inside and Out in the Valley This Weekend. We also have segment or part of a segment with Scott Cohen, who's a longtime local television and radio sportscaster here in the Valley. For the last couple of years, we have a segment called The Comedy Quiz, where individuals from a group called the Ha-Ha's, that started as the Ha-Ha Sisterhood, come on and actually have a comedy quiz that's really very funny. Another one, we have a segment called Your State You. We get the intro of this, and we have a lot of music beds for our intros with the UMass fight song. So it's called Your State You with Max Page. Max is a professor at UMass Amherst, and he was the founder of Phenom, the Public Higher Education Network of Massachusetts. So, like that. I mean, we have a lot of people and a lot of politicians, as we said, and we have the state Senate president who comes on now once a month for a segment. That's the show.
My guest is Bill Newman, and we're talking to him about his book and some other things. The book is Life on the Co-op Plan, Lessons from a 167-Year-Old Startup. You're listening to 91.3 WYSO, giving voice to our community, our nation, and our world. The Book Nook continues right after this. The Book Nook continues on WYSO. I'm Vic McCunis, and my guest today is Bill Newman, and he's written a book called Life on the Co-op Plan, Lessons from a 167-Year-Old Startup. Tell us about the structure. How did you decide to set the book up this way, and what's in it?
Well, it starts by describing the first co-op that I had from Anik, the first job I had. And I don't really know how quite to describe this. I was 18 years old and pretty naive. And there I was working in the New York criminal courts. Could I read you the first couple graphs of it? That might answer the question.
By all means.
Here's how it starts. In September 1968, I learned that I hated seeing people locked up in cages. I still do. I was 18 then and working in the New York City criminal courts for the Vera Institute of Justice's Experimental Diversion and Rehabilitation Project, the Manhattan Court Employment Project. This was my first job on Antioch College's co-op program. We Antioch students would sit at a beat-up metal desk behind Loopy, the arraignment sessions clerk, a man about 50, we guessed, who had a big laugh, a welcoming smile, and a terrible toupee that in the front rested a full one-quarter inch above his head. Every day we tried to not look at the chasm between Loopy's head and his hair, although honestly, sometimes it was hard not to. One more graph, if I might. Our job required us to review the criminal charges record and police reports of every person arrested in Manhattan to determine which defendants might qualify for the program. Most defendants didn't, either because they had previous convictions or had been brought in on drug charges or because they were facing serious felonies or because they were women. At that time, the program only accepted men. Mm-hmm. And then I go on to describe what it's like to work in the jails and the courts in New York, what it's like to work with these counselors, all of whom had done hard time, what it's like to walk in and out of jails by showing someone a card and hear this enormous clanging of the doors behind you when you walk into the trap. And that's how the book starts. Then I go on to my other co-ops at Antioch. I taught at the Antioch Preschool, where, as I say, I love the head teacher and learned a lot, including the fact that I totally lacked the patience to do that job well. I was an editorial assistant for Trans-Pacific, a literary magazine that was run by an English professor, literature professor at the college. And then my last co-op job from Antioch was working for the Urban Law Institute in Washington, D.C. So these were very meaningful experiences, and the book starts with those stories, and the title of that chapter is What Lasts? It's a question. And I try to answer that question by describing what I've done afterwards. What happens next in the book is a description of the 1970 National Student Strike at Antioch, and of course across the country, a Vietnam War protest where Antioch went on strike. So did colleges across and universities across the country. And I tell that story with a lot of writing that I actually did at the time. I kind of carried that around and had it in the back of desk drawers for many, many years. And on the 25th anniversary of Kent State, I turned that into a lengthy magazine piece, which was published in a magazine called Hampshire Life. And it got very good reviews. I said, I wonder where that story goes and where that story went between working in the jails and in courts and for law firms as an Antioch student. I came to these other pieces that I had written at various times about the legal work that I've done since then. So there's a piece, for example, on friends who served, because I was very and have been very moved by the Veterans Education Project in Amherst. And I write about the first gay custody case, because my partner Wendy Sibison and I litigated the first gay custody case that ever went to any state's highest court, and we won that case. So I tell that story as well. And then I go on, I talk about, I have a chapter called Happy Merry Hanukkah Kwanzaa Christmas, and talk about what it's like to be an ACLU lawyer during the winter holidays, where everyone wants to know, will this creche be permitted? Can I put these symbols up? I also talked about cases involving student takeovers or student takeover at UMass. I have go back and forth with various pieces that reflect on Antioch. There's a chapter called No Clowning Around, and I talk about a time when three or four of us went off, tried to go off to a Cincinnati Reds game from Yellow Springs, and we never made it. But we were with someone who was on his way after that to Ringling Brothers Barnum and Bailey Clown School, and so that was pretty funny. And then I tell the story of the other clown who I represented who was arrested, well, because the state trooper didn't think he was really that funny. So the stories are in that order that I think that are not necessarily chronological, although they try to be somewhat chronological because in storytelling, as you know, chronology is your friend. So they tell the first big chunk of the book after what lasts, after the introduction, the foreword by Antioch College President Tom Manley, after telling the story of working in the New York courts, are these descriptions and stories about the legal work that I've done after that. And then it goes on from there, and I talk about what it was like for me to be a parent. There's a series on reflections, which really are reflections on some of this work. I talk about the anti-war movement and where it has gone and how it manifests itself today. There are some pieces about writing and what is totally new from in this book, none of which obviously appeared in the previous version or iteration called When the War Came Home, is the writing I've done about the 2016 presidential election and the aftermath of that. And then, of course, there's a piece I actually really like, which ends the book, which is called Antioch Encounters, how I've run into Antioch in the last, 45 years since I've been there. Mm-hmm. And I really like that piece called Antioch Encounters.
I've had a few of those myself. My guest is Bill Newman. His book is Life on the Co-op Plan, Lessons from a 167-Year-Old Startup. And over the course of those years, almost one and two-thirds of centuries, Antioch's had its ups and downs. Why is Antioch College so important?
I think the most striking part of talking to people who attended Antioch, whether they graduated or not, is the indelible impression, the indelible mark, which the experience of being at the college, or at least being part of the college, has made on his or her life. And why exactly that happens and why it happens differently at Antioch than in other colleges, I can't tell you exactly. But there's something about the ethos of the college. There's something about that almost a mantra, which, as Tom Manley writes in his introduction to this book, is somehow imbued in the college and its experience, which is that really quite extraordinary statement from Horace Mann, which is to be afraid to die until you have won some victory for humanity. And, you know, there are not too many colleges that have that or something like that as the underlying principle, the guiding principle of the institution. And I think that principle manifests itself in the student body and the faculty and the reasons for attending this college. And I think it shows in the lives and the purpose of the lives of the people who have attended.
I really enjoyed this book. And some of the high points for me were your really early writings, where and of course I loved a lot of the really late writings too, particularly when you're talking about President Trump. But the early ones that you alluded to, where you've gone and you've looked back at these things that you wrote when you were so young and self-absorbed and long-haired and experimenting with different things. You just mentioned that time that you were in that very nice car going to supposedly see a baseball game and that whole adventure and what it felt like to be a guy with long hair back in the early 70s in rural Ohio. Just that feeling, you really recaptured that vibe and the feelings we had about Richard Nixon. I remember those times very well. You talk about these photos that, for those of us who lived through it, all you have to do is describe that photo, and I knew exactly what photos you were talking about. And then that one of the woman at Kent State on her knees with that look of agony, These are just that they're searing the mind. You'll never forget these images.
I think that's right. And it's very hard to describe for someone who is not there what it felt like to live through the late 1960s and early 1970s, and in particular what it felt like to be at Antioch College, where no one was going to tell you what to do or what to think or how you should spend your life or whether, for that matter, you should stay there or whether you should be studying or whether you should be working and how you should feel or whether you should go to jail or whether conscientious objector status was a valid way to express your opposition to the war and should you go to every demonstration and what about the people who have dropped out of college because they think they should be spending full time fighting this war and what kind of privilege are you not only exercising but enjoying and exacerbating by being in a nice cozy college when people across the country are being killed, are being maimed, are being maced in demonstrations, when the Black Liberation Movement and the Civil Rights Movement are being targeted by the federal government, when the Black Panthers are, of course, being subjected to enormous police harassment and brutality, and for that matter, official and officially sanctioned deaths. I mean, these were complicated times, and I'm not saying that I answered any of those questions very well at the time, but it wasn't for lack of trying. And what Antioch did, and I think does, is make people try to answer very difficult questions.
You did a splendid job of depicting the feeling of getting that draft lottery number and looking at the list, and your story about going to the post office with that letter, that was priceless.
Yes, we should say that. It was priceless. I almost had a heart attack. I was trying to have a letter postmarked by the 31st of December because it had to be postmarked 1971, and the postal clerk took the letter and threw it into the bin without postmarking it, which was the proof to the selective service system when I mailed it. Oh, my goodness. I really did almost have a heart attack then. But fortunately, the clerk did fish the letter out and did put a stamp on it. And the story that we're talking about involves my having these mental gymnastics saying, he's looking at this long-haired kid saying, please take that letter out and put a stamp on it, because a date stamp on it, because if you don't, I might go to Vietnam and get killed there. And as soon as I said it, my thought was, oh, my God, this is a federal employee, postal clerk by reputation. This is a pretty conservative group of people. And what if he's looking at me saying, sending this kid to Vietnam and having all his hair cut off and sending him to the Army, that sounds like a pretty good thing. So It was a very, very intense moment, and I remember it clearly. I understand that memories sometimes can distort and distract, but I remember that moment. I remember looking in that bin of letters.
Well, you certainly recapture that era, and for those of us who were there, we remember it. We remember those feelings, from the really serious, stressful ones like you trying to get that letter postmarked, to the more fun and frivolous moments, which you apparently treasure, because I think you mentioned it a couple times. I've heard about this place. There used to be a bakery that would have fresh donuts, and the kids would go down there with the munchies at midnight to get those nice warm donuts.
They did. We did. I'm not sure it made it into this book, but I do remember being at the bakery one night. It did open at midnight. There were freshly baked warm donuts. There were, as you say, any number of people who were very, very hungry for reasons that need not be discussed at great length and probably self-evident. And I remember standing behind someone one night, and he said, I'd like a half a dozen glazed and a chocolate milk. And he turned to the person he was with and said, what would you like?
Sounds about right. Yeah. Sounds pretty normal.
It was at the time, yeah.
Yeah. The book is Life on the Co-op Plan, Lessons from a 167-Year-Old Startup. My guest is Bill Newman. He joins us on the telephone from Massachusetts. And I'll continue my conversation with Bill right after this. You're listening to the Book Nook on WYSO. I'm Vic McCunis, and it's my pleasure to have Bill Newman on the program. We're talking about his book, Life on the Co-op Plan, Lessons from a 167-Year-Old Startup. And as we get near the end of the book, we have some sections in here that were written fairly recently because they're talking about these recent elections that we've had and things that have happened recently. You've got one called A Message from Edward Snowden. You've got one about the Marathon bombers in Boston and some very, very topical, very current stuff. And then you've also got all your sections broken down into subsections, and each of these different areas have quotes from Antioch College grads mostly. And I found some of these quite informative. In fact, you had a couple of quotes in there from people who have appeared on this program, Jorma Kaukonen and Jose Ramos Horta, a couple of very different guests.
Very different. I had a great research assistant who's an Antioch student who helped me with the quotes and with the alums, as well as some quotes from some faculty who either have been at Antioch recently or are at Antioch. And I loved actually looking at all these quotes from some people I just did not know before I started. I mean, we're Antioch alums. So, I mean, some I did, but some I didn't. The pieces that you just mentioned, I think it's worth noting, are part of a chapter called The More Things Change. Mm-hmm. And what they do is they go back and they reflect on some of the same issues that I was confronted with and that the country was confronted with 40, 45 years ago, and that I started working on as a lawyer, you know, 40 years ago. So, and I think that showing how these same issues in different forms continue to confront us is important. And I love the quote from Leon Higginbotham, who is, mm-hmm. of course, the chief judge for the Third Circuit Court of Appeals, and he won a Presidential Medal of Freedom Award, and he graduated Antioch. He's the late Judge Higginbotham, who is part of the Antioch College class of 1949. But I love this quote. He says, quote, "I will make two requests of you, that you always attempt to see those human beings who become invisible to most people, and that you always try to hear the pleas of those persons who, despite their pain and suffering, have become voiceless and forgotten." And people who've graduated Antioch have done and said and written and created just amazing, amazing pieces of work and literature and paintings, and contributed in a thousand ways to the country. And I loved being able to, for example, have a quote from Rod Serling, who's the creator of the Twilight Zone, above the quote from the founder of Hot Tuna, who was also an Antioch grad. So they were some 14 years apart. And it was, for me, an exploration. Writing the book was in part an exploration of what Antioch has been and what its promise continues to be.
Well, I loved Hot Tuna, but I think of him as the guitarist for Jefferson Airplane.
Yeah, well, me too, but yeah. Trying to relate to, you know, contemporary listeners.
Well, good luck with that. No, I'm just kidding. If you're anything like me, you're probably looking at our current president, who seems to be trying to have sort of an imperial presidency, and you keep flashing back, if you're like me, to the guy who we remember so well, who you mentioned with such great affection in this book, Richard M. Nixon. We're constantly seeing these weird parallels, aren't we?
Well, there are. That said, my opinion of Nixon as a politician has actually changed significantly, some for the worse and some for the better. Uh-huh. I was appalled to learn or to hear the confirmation that Nixon had actually gone and sent an emissary to the South Vietnamese government, telling them not to make a peace deal before the election because he would get them a better peace deal after he was elected, thereby prolonging the Vietnam War for years and years and years, resulting in perhaps a million or more, maybe even 2 million more deaths of Vietnamese, another 25 or 30,000 American service personnel who were dead and who died because he wanted a political advantage in that election. It just boggles the mind that he did that. Nixon, of course, denied that up till his dying day that it happened, but apparently there's no question now about the history that he did exactly that. At the same time, Nixon would be drummed out of the Republican Party today for being too liberal.
Mm-hmm.
He is the person who went to China. Jack Kennedy could not have gone to Red China. He would have been impeached. Nixon was the person who founded OSHA, the Occupational Safe and Healthy Health Administration. And he was the president who inaugurated the Environmental Protection Agency. Can you imagine Donald Trump saying, yes, we really want to support the Environmental Protection Agency because clean water and clean air is something that's a birthright of Americans and people throughout the world. Okay, so he might say that, but honestly, Nixon did affirmatively undertook legislation that was really important for part of a liberal or progressive agenda. Nixon proposed what became Obamacare.
Uh-huh.
Nixon proposed a health care bill, a quasi-universal health care bill that is very close to Obamacare. It was drafted by the Heritage Foundation, and it was based on insurance companies providing the insurance coverage, which was how the Republicans wanted to pay for it. And that's what they got. Now, of course, by the time Obamacare or the Affordable Care Act was passed, the Republicans said, well, it's horrible, it's a disgusting, ridiculous, stupid, expensive, it'll never work piece of legislation because Obama proposed it. But really, it was a conservative Republican bill when first proposed. And then, of course, the Heritage Foundation disavowed it. But that was just politics. The truth is, it was a very conservative way of trying to achieve health care, health insurance for most Americans. So this was a Nixon proposal, and Teddy Kennedy opposed it. Teddy Kennedy said that opposing that health care bill in its various forms being the worst mistake he ever made, that he did make in his senatorial career.
Well, I have an enduring fascination with Dick Nixon, and like you, I can remember him way back when he was Eisenhower's VP. And just a little footnote, in regard to the EPA, he was such a politician. Don't you think part of his motivation for creating the EPA was because he thought he'd be running against Ed Muskie in 72, and he wanted to kind of preempt some of Ed Muskie's environmentalism?
Yes. I think that Nixon was Machiavellian in his motivation, but he nonetheless did it.
Mm-hmm.
He said his political read was people care about the environment,
mm-hmm.
so I'm going to take that issue away from the Democrats. And he did, to a significant degree. Can you imagine Donald Trump said, well, people are going to care about the environment? Because what Donald Trump has done is rescind almost two dozen of the most important environmental protection regulations that were put into place by the Obama administration, and he could care less. I mean, he says, well, say anything, but he has said, I favor clean air and clean water, but then all of his policies are saying, here, coal companies, dump your ash wherever you want, pollute the streams to your heart's content, and if it makes an extra penny per share, that's great with us. We really don't care how this adversely affects people and their health. But Nixon wouldn't have done it that way. And I think what it does show is how far to the right the country has moved and how successful the right wing has been in co-opting coverage and the news media. And I find it frightening. But here's a frightening fact. I heard, this was on PBS just this past weekend, that some 37% of the country think that as a source of news, that they have a high degree of confidence in the accuracy and honesty and completeness of Donald Trump.
Well, that's called the base. That's his base. My guest is Bill Newman. You admit in the book that you were a Bernie Sanders guy anyway, right?
Yes. I do.
Yeah, yeah.
This book, it takes us from that 18-year-old kid, that innocent who went on that 9-month-long co-op in the jails in New York City, and brings us all the way up to the present day to here you are sitting in your chair in your office in Massachusetts. It takes us all through. It's a memoir, but it's also very much about Antioch College. Antioch College is really kind of at the center of it, isn't it?
It is. I think that the lessons I learned there I've kept, and they've been meaningful to me. And I end the book by saying this. The truth is I wasn't remotely prepared to attend a college like Antioch, but I never seriously considered going to another college. And during the 4 years I was enrolled there, never seriously considered leaving either. For me, Antioch was great. It also was hard. No one told me it was supposed to be. I only realized that long after the fact. And that's true. And what I write in this book is, for me, true.
And you're coming back to Yellow Springs for the reunion.
I am. I haven't been there in 45 years. I'm really looking forward to it, and I have a little bit of trepidation. But I think it's going to be a fabulous reunion, and I'm really looking forward to talking with other people who have had similar kinds of experiences, because the kinds of experiences I've had are, I think, everyone's unique, of course, and everyone's life is unique, but I think this is in some ways fairly typical of an Antioch experience and the kinds of work that people have done since then.
Are you hitchhiking in?
That's a great question, but no, I must admit I am taking a plane.
Okay. Well, you mentioned hitchhiking in the book, and that's another lost art. I can remember when we lived in different times. You would stick your thumb out, and it was an adventure. You weren't afraid particularly.
I think that's true, and if you were driving, you'd happily pick people up if you had room in the car. And I do remember one time hitchhiking out of Yellow Springs. I was hitchhiking to Xenia, and I was picked up by a trucker who proceeded to tell me how he was one of the few men, and it was clear there were men, drivers who would actually, from that company, drive to Yellow Springs because they thought it was just full of hippies, and they just couldn't imagine even driving into Yellow Springs because of that. Seriously.
But
at least this guy picked me up. Who knew?
You strike me as a somewhat stubborn attorney. You mentioned earlier about this custody case, this landmark custody case that you said you won, but you only won it because you were obstinate. Didn't the judge keep ruling against you?
The judge did rule against us a lot. It was probate in family court, and in family court, the judge has an enormous amount of discretion. So it was really necessary to make all of the facts that could be used to deprive a lesbian mom of her daughters, you need to make those facts disappear. And I, in fact, or at least not be admitted into the record, or not found as facts by the judge. And so I was, in fact, trying to keep a very close eye on what this record would look like when, as we expected, it would go up and did go up on appeal. And at one point I'd objected to some testimony, and the judge says something like, "Oh, objection, objection. If you don't stop objecting, Mr. Newman, we're never going to get through this trial." I said, "That's okay with me, Judge. It will take as long as it takes." But he was actually not a mean judge. He was deeply disturbed, ultimately, about not letting Mom, the trial judge, about not letting Mom have her daughters back. It bothered him. Didn't bother him enough to allow Mom to have her daughters back, but he was, in his own way, really, I think, thoughtful. He tried to do the right thing, and interestingly, the trial court judge was very honest. The trial court judge made as a finding that Mom was a lesbian, and then his judgment, being a lesbian per se, infused the household with an element of instability that was necessarily adverse to the best interests of the children, and that's why they shouldn't go back to their mom. And a lot of judges would have just glossed over that or buried that fact. That would have been their reason, but they would know that's going to be an appeal point. That's going to be something that an appellate court can really look at. And in fact, an appellate court, the Supreme Judicial Court of Massachusetts, did exactly that. So that, yes, that judge ruled against us, the trial judge ruled against us, but he was honest. He gave his real reason for not letting mom reassume the custody of her children after the guardianship. And it was that honesty in the record that allowed the Supreme Judicial Court to say, no, sexual preference is not a basis to deprive a parent of custody of her children.
Yeah, it's kind of like honesty in a presidential tweet kind of coming back to bite you.
Well,
but we won't go there.
Well, I would say this, you know, in this instance, I think the judge was willing to take the consequences of writing that honesty, as opposed to Trump, who wants everyone to forget about what he said. So when it comes to his Muslim ban and Trump saying, I want to ban Muslims, and then his lawyers get up in court and say, oh, you can't pay attention to that, just the president talking. Kellyanne Conway, don't pay attention to what he said. You should pay attention to what's in his heart. You couldn't make this stuff up. It would make for a bad novel.
True.
But here we are living it.
We're reading it every day on social media. My guest is Bill Newman. His book is Life on the Co-op Plan, Lessons from a 167-Year-Old Startup. I have just enough time to mention one of my favorite sections in here, and it's called National Pastimes, where you out yourself as a New York Yankee fan. And two of your favorite players were Mickey Mantle and Yogi Berra. And we've heard a lot of talk about yogiisms, particularly since his passing recently, but you look at them a little bit differently. You tie them in with current events.
I do in that, in both the piece about Yogi Berra and about Mickey Mantle, and I talk about the era in which they lived and how they were really emblematic of it, mostly in a very positive way. But I think that divorcing sports heroes and icons from the era in which they played and the era which they represent in our both our imagination and our memory is really important. So in the piece about Yogi Berra, I talk about Dwight Eisenhower's presidency and Kennedy becoming president. And I talk about a book about by political activist Ellen Mirapol and a program we did together at the Wellfleet Library. And I talk about with Mickey Mantle about what baseball means and what it doesn't mean and why we think of it the way we do. And I think these are parts of the American experience that are worthy of pausing and reflecting on, because they tell us something about ourselves, both good and bad.
Well, Bill, it's been a pleasure having you on the program.
Thank you so very much. It's just been a great pleasure to speak with you, and I look forward to meeting you when I'm in Yellow Springs.
All right. Well, after 45 years, I don't know if I'll recognize you. I'm just kidding.
But you, I'll recognize you without any doubt?
For sure.
Okay, I appreciate that.
Our guest has been Bill Newman. His book is Life on the Co-op Plan, Lessons from a 167-Year-Old Startup. And as Bill mentioned during our interview, he is returning to Yellow Springs for his class reunion, and that's coming up 1 week from today, next weekend. And he has an event, a book signing, and the public is invited to attend, and that will be right here on the campus of Antioch College in Yellow Springs. And Bill will be signing copies of Life on the Co-op Plan, Lessons from a 167-Year-Old Startup, at 8:30 on the morning of Saturday, July 15th. And this will be at the beautiful Herndon Gallery on the campus of Antioch College. That's at 8:30 on Saturday, July 15th, 8:30 in the morning. So set your alarm clocks and come out to Yellow Springs and meet Bill, his first return to Yellow Springs in 45 years. He's coming in for reunion weekend, and he'll be autographing copies of the book and talking about it. His session in the Herndon Gallery here on the campus of Antioch College. That's at 8:30 in the morning, July 15th, 1 week from today. You can meet Bill. He's flying in from Massachusetts. He said he's not going to be hitchhiking this time. Kind of taking it easy. And we hope that you can come out to Yellow Springs for reunion weekend. There will be many Antiochians there, but you're all invited to meet Bill and hear about his experiences at Antioch College, this 167-year-old startup. For the Book Nook, I'm Vic McCunis, broadcasting from the campus of Antioch College on WYSO.